Thanks for downloading the podcast. Be sure to like the Polite Politics community fan page on Facebook and be sure to tell your friends. Welcome into the Polite Politics podcast. I'm your host, Tyler Page. Got a great show for you today. We're going to talk all about ISIS, Syria, and the refugee crisis that's going on right now and all of the issues surrounding it. You know, a lot of this was on the American mind for a long time, but with the deadly attacks in Paris, which were tragic, I think it really brought it to the forefront for a lot of people. So we're going to start, we're going to go through four items here. First, we're going to give a quick history of ISIS. Who are they? Where did they come from? Next, we're going to talk about why Syria matters. Why is it that people care what's going on and what's happening there? Next, we're going to talk about the big political question, whose fault is it? A lot of people try to throw blame at President Obama, former President Bush. I'm going to talk about that. Finally, going to talk about the plans President Obama and the presidential candidates are proposing. I'm not going to go each one by one, but I'm going to give you an idea of kind of the range of opinions there and then let you make your decision. Now, the history of ISIS, and there will be a link to a really great piece from the preeminent think tank on Near Eastern Studies in the United States. But ISIS started in 1999 from a man by the name of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. I'll just call him Zarqawi for the rest of this. He was a Jordanian-born man and of the poor classes, but very, very charismatic. He spent time in Afghanistan and started his organization up in 1999 with some seed money from Osama bin Laden. Now, he started the group. I'm going to try to pronounce this once and then I won't pronounce it again. It's Jamaat al-Tahid wa-e-Jihad, I believe is the name of it. And it's important to understand that Al-Qaeda and, to a larger extent, just terrorist groups in general, are not necessarily very organized. There's a lot of individual franchises with individual groups kind of doing their own thing and affiliating in some places and not. So it became a competitor with Al-Qaeda for leader of the global jihad movement, and they both kind of tried to push that. The best way to describe Osama bin Laden and Zarqawi, in my mind, are frenemies. They somewhat friends, they have similar ideology, but somewhat different. Osama bin Laden repeatedly tried to co-opt him, Zarqawi repeatedly turned him down. But then in October 2004, Zarqawi was fighting in Iraq. He had led a lot of the insurgency in Iraq. In October of 2004, after 8 months of negotiations, he decided to pledge loyalty to Osama bin Laden and renamed his group Al-Qaeda in Iraq. You know, our experts describe this as a marriage of convenience, and it should be noted that Al-Qaeda headquarters under bin Laden, and even after bin Laden, thought Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or Zarqawi's group, was too extreme. They were too violent, and they were forcing Sharia law on too many people too fast. That was their approach. 2006, Zarqawi consolidated a bunch of other groups together with Al-Qaeda in Iraq under another banner I'm not even going to try, but it's sometimes called MSM. But then in 2007, he was killed. 2006-2007, Zarqawi was killed, and the Iraq surge really decimated Al-Qaeda in Iraq and really minimized it. And so by the end of 2008, and especially as our troops began to draw down in 9, 10, and 11, and in 2012, if you look at the violence numbers, they were dropping dramatically. Very, very little violence going on over there. Things had pretty much calmed down. But in 2011, ISI, which was the new name for the group, they've had five names, ISI, began a comeback, and there was an uprising in Syria, and this uprising really came as a result of the Arab Spring. We're going to talk about that in a minute, but really kind of began a comeback and began working there. In April 2013, their leader announced they were relocating to Syria to fight there. And in February 2014, they had a formal split with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda said, we're no longer affiliated, we're not affiliated. And now they're fighting each other in Syria, Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Sometimes you'll hear them called ISIL. But all of these groups that Jamaat al-Tahid wa-i-Jihad, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, MSM, ISI, ISIS, and ISIL, all the same group, just at different points in time. And ISIS and ISIL, you're looking at differences in translation. So I'm just going to use the phrase ISIS. President Obama sometimes uses ISIL. I'll let you make your pick. It doesn't really matter. Now, ISIS in 2014 really became something that the American people became aware of because they started taking hostages. They started cutting people's heads off. And they took over cities in Iraq and in Syria. And now they control a lot of territory. And I'm including a photograph of a map so you can kind of see their influence growing. But they call themselves ISIS, which in part stands for the Islamic State. And they believe in creating a worldwide caliphate, which is a theocracy led by a Muslim leader under which everybody would have to follow Sharia or Islamic law. And to some degree, they believe that they're kind of bringing around the end of the world by creating this kind of perfect Muslim utopia. Now, so that's kind of a history of ISIS and who they are. Like I said, really starts with Zarqawi back in 1999 and is doing terrorist activities. And then after 9/11 and after the invasion of Iraq, moves to Iraq, eventually joins up and has kind of a love-hate relationship with Al-Qaeda. Once again, decimated toward the end of the Bush administration and almost non-existent until the uprising in Syria, where they started recruiting again and really getting involved there and have really found a foothold in Syria and now hold some territory in Iraq as well. So let's talk about Syria. Their leader, Bashar al-Assad, I apologize if I'm mispronouncing some of these names, is a really bad, bad dude. He's a tyrant, he's a despot, and he has horribly mistreated his people. As part of the Arab Spring in March 2011, protests began against him. And in August of that same year, so just a few months later, President Obama demanded that he step down. A year later, President Obama was meeting with reporters, and he was getting some pressure because Syria was starting to massacre some of its people, and he was standing by. And in the midst of a presidential election, he said something that his aides said was not planned and that they were really unhappy about, which was he said it was, quote-unquote, a red line if Syria started moving around chemical weapons or using them against their people. Now, generally, the phrase red line would imply if you cross that, we will use military force. And in some cases, I mean, depending on how you want to use that phrase, could imply using very serious force or nuclear arsenal or others. Otherwise, in this case, President Obama appeared to just be saying that we would take military action. And it seems like a throwaway line more to appear tough, because the next year, when it became clear that Syria had used chemical weapons against their own people, and it was verified not only by initial sources, but by the United Nations and President Obama's own administration, President Obama really refused to do anything about it. And Republicans harp on him for looking weak, but to be fair to him, I'm not convinced that it would have been really wise to do a whole lot, and that'll get into our final stages. So at the very least, you know, if you're a fan of President Obama here, the least you can say is he tried to talk tough before an election and ended up getting his bluff called and ended up looking bad. That's the good version, and I'll let you figure out the bad version, but I think that's probably more accurate. It's just he tried to talk a little tougher than he really meant to, got his bluff called, and ended up looking foolish. Now, starting in June 2014, the United States started to do some things to address this. We had been selling weapons and giving some weapons over to militants. In June of this last year, in 2014, we started moving a few thousand troops over to Iraq and into Syria. They're ostensibly there. I mean, we hear about quote-unquote boots on the ground. We hear a lot of talk about that. We'll get into that in a second. But the thought with this, is the idea is we're going to train Syrian rebels to help fight against Assad, because the issue we have is that Assad is unpopular, so people are trying to fight against him. And some of them are ISIS, and some of them are Al-Qaeda, and some are just quote-unquote moderates. And the moderates are a little more aligned with Al-Qaeda, but not as aligned with Al-Qaeda. Some aren't at all. And so the thought was, well, we'll help people topple Assad, and the Obama administration kind of encouraged that. But ISIS has used that as a vacuum to come in and take over. So now you have everybody fighting against everybody. We've started bombing. We're dropping quite a few bombs. Something, I'm seeing numbers like 600 bombs a week, depending on who you ask and where it is. But we are dropping, and we're trying to destroy targets in there. We also have some people on the ground. And this was a little bit of an embarrassment to the administration. There was a policy of training and arming Syrian rebels and trying to help them out. The problem is it failed miserably. We spent $500 million, and the Pentagon recently acknowledged that they had 4 to 5 people who were still fighting on our side in Syria. So that's just for those of you doing the math. That's $100 to $125 million per rebel, and that's what we're paying. So it's been halted and revised. President Obama went on television and, in something I thought was stunning, said, well, I never thought that would work, but his administration pushed it. It was kind of a weird situation. So here we are. The United States has attempted to arm and failed to arm and train Syrian rebels. We continue to bomb ISIS to try and pull them back. We famously, in the northern part of Iraq, stopped them from slaughtering a group of people. But whose fault is all this? Well, people have tried to blame George W. Bush, saying he created ISIS. Well, that's not true. They were created in 1999. Or Barack Obama for not doing something in Syria. And I think either criticism is really oversimplifying the situation. The United States chose to invade Iraq. And whatever you think of that decision, and I think most people think it was a mistake at this point, but the situation was a pretty good situation when President Obama inherited it. The surge had really eliminated most of the violence there. Al-Qaeda in Iraq at the time, now ISIS, was pretty much gone. Its leader had been killed. And President Obama, for the first few years of his presidency, ISIS really didn't do anything. They had very minimal influence. But as this problem started to happen in Syria and in other places with the Arab world, President Obama's hands were tied, to be fair, because the American public simply was not going to accept another ground invasion with troops in the Middle East. The American public just wasn't going to do that. And you'll see that even when the Obama administration, we now have troops deployed in Iraq again, and in Syria, we have some troops deployed in Iraq, I should say, 1,000, 2,500, depending on which announcement you're looking at. We have a few thousand troops over there. We're not admitting we have them. We're saying, oh, they're just on training missions. They're not actually running combat missions. So we have troops there. But you'll see the administration go to pains to try and paint this is different. This isn't the same thing. And to some degree, that's true. But my point is that President Obama had his hands tied a little bit by the perceptions of invading Middle Eastern countries that came from President Bush's policy decisions. However, President Obama rose to power largely because of that hatred of the Iraq War. So it's hard to see him, allow him to be that critical of President Bush for tying his hands when the only reason he's president is because of that. So, here are my thoughts. Number one, President Bush. The decision to invade Iraq created some elements of this, but Al-Qaeda in Iraq first existed before and was committing acts of terrorism before and was pretty much decimated when President Obama took office. Saying he created ISIS is flat out 100% false. At the most, President Bush is going to receive some minimal criticism that's just part of the larger failed policy of rebuilding Iraq. One of these days I'm going to do a podcast about Iraq and what happened. In my mind, we need to be pointing a lot more blame at the State Department and a lot more less at the Defense Department, but that's for another day. President Obama, you know, he is who the American people wanted. He came to power on this fight against military interventions, and he has, for the most part, resisted them. Instead, in a lot of places, preferring very minimal group boots on the ground, maybe a few people who are spotting air targets for our Air Force to go take out, and maybe some of this selling of weapons and training people. He is somewhat a prisoner of that mindset, but that's what he wanted. If you're going to blame any American president, I think you have to blame President Obama more, just because ISIS didn't really become resurgent until 2011. Which is, you know, a couple years into President Obama's presidency. But I'm not sure that anyone here deserves blame. And the idea that we just look at a president and say, well, it happened on your watch, therefore it's your fault, is really overly simplistic and kind of silly. Look at the specific policies that were had and taken. And for all the people who were saying, wow, well, what if we just intervened in Syria? I say, yeah, what if we had intervened in Syria? What if we had dropped 100,000 troops? We would have Al-Qaeda and ISIS, unique separate groups, distinct from each other, both trying to kill all of our troops and fighting along with, and you would have taken Assad's military that we would have pushed out. You would have had another Iraq, and it would have been a worse situation, I think, because it would have been more coordinated and better set up, and you would have seen more opportunities for Iran to grow in power. I just think there were no real good options here with Syria. So let's talk about the plans that people are looking at. Well, before we do that, let's actually talk about refugees, and then we'll talk about the military plans. So the result of this is that Syria is a disaster, and so guess what? A lot of people want to leave, and understandably, they're having a refugee crisis. Now, the United States historically has taken refugees from all over the world, and Syria is no exception. There are worries, however, that ISIS militants could potentially infiltrate and pretend to be refugees and use that as a path to get into the United States to commit acts of terrorism. There is some suspicion and that this could have fed what happened in Paris. As of this writing, this recording, I don't believe we have a definitive answer on that. But the head of President Obama's FBI says it's possible. And says we couldn't possibly vet all the refugees who are coming in. Now, the House Republicans, the Republicans with many Democrats, just passed a bill demanding people actually get vetted before coming in. President Obama has threatened to veto that legislation. But it's interesting that it's going to the Senate, and we'll see. With the vote we have in the House right now, remember the president, if the president vetoes a bill, it goes back to the House and Senate who can potentially override it. And that rarely happens, but it would take two-thirds of the House and Senate. With the vote that happened in the House, President Obama's veto would have been overridden. But it was close. It was because there were eight abstentions or eight people who didn't vote who potentially could have voted, and they only needed one more vote with the full House voting. So here's the point. It looks like the House could override it. Now we'll see if the Senate could override that veto. President Obama has started accusing Republicans of kicking out widows and orphans and doing what ISIS wants them to do and really using, I think, overheated rhetoric that I think all people can agree is a little much. But there is this interesting question of what is our responsibility and what is our obligation here? You have people who potentially could be infiltrated by people who are harmed. You have who would harm us, but you also have a huge humanitarian disaster, which I'm seeing some publications compare to German or Jews trying to flee Germany in 1938, right before the onset of World War II. It's a tough spot, and I think it's understandable. I wish people could discuss these issues a little more responsibly on all sides, because I think both sides have legitimate arguments here. But instead of talking about it responsibly, instead we have one side saying you're going to allow attack on our homeland, and you have the other side trying to compare Nazi sympathizers, is the phraseology that's being used. And I think both sides just need to calm down, look at this situation, and see if they can find a middle ground. In my view, I think this bill that the House Republicans are passing that simply calls for the FBI to actually vet the individuals coming into the country seems reasonable, but I haven't studied it up enough to give you all of the details. It's certainly not the, anti-Semitic legislation of the 1930s. So we'll see what happens there. But what I will say is, once again, there's a huge number of Democrats who are supporting this legislation, and so President Obama really needs to tone down the rhetoric. Now, in terms of plans for how to deal with Syria, President Obama has essentially argued that we should stay the course. We need to have limited bombings that will never, that we are not allowed to have any collateral damage of killing of any civilians. We're just going to blow up ISIS militants that we see. Their attempts to get other nations involved, I think it's pretty minimal. What's funny about ISIS is they're a much bigger threat to Saudi Arabia than they are to the United States. And yet we can't seem to get the Saudis to do a darn thing about them. Or they'll do a little, but not a lot. And that's true for most, all the Arab governments, as well as Iran, who isn't technically Arab. But all of the Middle Eastern governments, they're a bigger threat to them than they are to us. And yet those countries sure don't seem willing to get that involved. But there's look to try and get that, try to get those other Muslim countries involved in trying to stop Syria. The other, and we'll see about arming rebels right now, that's been taken off the table, but we still do have soldiers on the ground helping to spot. Talking in the neighborhood of a few thousand, not the 100,000 troop commitment that, like, the Iraq War was. Now, the other candidates have a lot of variations around this theme, and what I will say is most don't really have any more ideas. They're simply saying, well, let's add a few more troops, but not too many, or let's bomb more. There are some groups, now remember, Iraq has fought with some sectarian violence. There are three different ethnic groups or groups in Iraq, the Kurds, the Shia, and the Sunni, all who have slightly different approach. The Kurds are a different ethnic group. Shia and Sunni Muslims are two different branches of Islam. And they have been fighting, and that's been a lot of the problem we've had in Iraq, was them fighting each other. And so there's been a hesitancy to arm the Kurds specifically, because while they could probably fight the Syrians, there's a worry of who else they would fight or what they would do. There's been some arguments for that. And then you have more the Rand Paul wing of this, more libertarian wing, which says, look, let's just stop trying. Let's get out of it. Now, because of the attacks in Paris, everybody seems to have the same approach of we need to do something, with the exception of Rand Paul. I'm not convinced that we need to do something. I think, everybody's got their own opinion on that, and I'll leave it to you to decide and pick the candidates that you want. But for right now, for all the criticism President Obama is getting, everybody's policies look very similar to me. Like I said, add a few more troops, but not too many. Bomb a little more, but not too much more. I mean, and there are lines that people could draw there. But you're still dealing with the fact that people on the ground in Syria. You have a lot of terrorists who are taking over that country. And you have a group of people who are, well, let's put it this way. You have a civil war, but neither side is good. It's bad guys versus bad guys. And how we choose which ones we want to side with is just a real mess. So I'll leave it to you to take a look at these plans, but I would hope that you'd be a little cynical and skeptical looking at all of these candidates, including our president, who say they're doing something. I'm not convinced any of them are really taking much of a risk. If somebody said, I want to commit 100,000 troops and we are gonna set that up, I'm not saying that's the right thing to do, but that would actually be something different. We're bombing folks a little here, a little there. It's not solving the problem. That's not to say that it's not the right solution, but it's all we're doing right now with some minimal training on the ground. Ultimately, the people of Syria have to decide that they want a civilized world, and I'm not convinced that they've given us any indication that that's what they want. So we're all left with a bad situation. Anyway, that's our show. Thank you so much for listening. I hope this was useful. A little history of ISIS in Syria, and we will be back next week to talk about another hot topic. Have a great week and a happy Thanksgiving. Hey everyone, thanks for downloading the podcast. Do you disagree with something I said? You're probably not alone. Shoot me an email at tpage@politepolitics.com, and if you make a good point, I'll read it on the air.